So good morning, it's Parshas Bereishis. Take a few minutes to study some Rashis that I haven't talked about in the past. Some of the lesser known but still interesting Rashis. A little bit of noise in the background. I'm trying to do some work on my house before the winter. So I've got my friends from the local Palestinian village. We actually are very, very friendly for many, many years. We just did some coffee together and they're in the background working. So I'm trying to, between that and between running to give my daily share, record a few Rashis. So in the second parak where a woman, where Chav in this case, is created from man's rib, Zos hapam etzem etzemai, part of Adam, basar mibsari. Therefore, since she comes from Adam, she's called, or women are called by a name that's similar to how men are referred to. Men are ish, women are isha. Lezos, this type of sex or gender, yikare isha, kimi ish lukachazos. So she'll be referred to as an isha because she came from an ish, and the word ish and isha are very similar in Hebrew. In other languages, not being such a linguist, the word for women and the word for men may be very different. In English, they happen to be very similar, man and woman. But in Hebrew, ish and isha are extremely similar. And based on this, Rashi writes, lashon nofala lashon. The word ish is very similar to the word isha. They sound the same. They represent the fact that they are that the woman is created for man. And Rashi says, here you see, mikan shenivro olam b'lashon hakodesh. Here you see that the world was created using Hebrew, that Hebrew was the first language. It's the language HaKadosh Baruch Hu used, quote-unquote, to create the world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world with some form of speech. Basar Mamar is very different from our speech, but at some level there was some statement, Yior, Yichoshech, HaKadosh Baruch Hu used Hebrew words. Now this is fascinating because typically we relate to languages as human convention. Languages emerge through human convention. People start using certain words to communicate, to refer to certain objects, experiences, people, and then those words coalesce into a language. So there is no such thing as an objective language. It's all communication. Communication is human-based, human convention. Is there a language that's absolute? Is there a language that's objective, that's, in this case, divine and eternal and predates human experience? According to Rashi, it is, and it's Lashon HaKodesh. And there's an interesting Rambam, which I always thought maybe put that and raise questions about this issue. The Rambam in the Morne Vuchim asks, why is Lashon HaKodesh? Why is Hebrew, as we call it? Why is it referred to as Lashon HaKodesh? So the answer to that question should be because it's Hashem's language, and it's the language Hashem used to create the world, and it's the language HaKadosh Baruch Hu used to create the Torah. That's why it's Lashon HaKodesh, because unlike English and French and Portuguese, which are human convention, this is, as Rashi says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created those words. The Rambam says it's called Lashon HaKodesh because there aren't direct references to sexual activity. It's all idioms. It's all the secondary reference points, and therefore our minds are less, they less conjure up vivid activities. It's more indirect references. That's why it's called Lashon HaKodesh. Does that Rambam mean that it isn't Lashon HaKodesh and it isn't the language of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Or he's asking a different question. Why is it called Lashon HaKodesh as opposed to Lashon Hashem? But basically, we feel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a language that's independent of human convention. And there's also a second question. Is Lashon HaKodesh, did Hashem choose this language because he knew that Am Yisrael would accept the Torah and therefore that he would deliver the Torah in Hebrew and he knew that the other nations of the world wouldn't accept the Torah? Very interesting question. Let's say B'nai Esav and B'nai Yishmael had accepted the Torah. Would the Torah have been delivered to them in Hebrew or their language? We would like to feel, it seems pretty obvious to us. Rashi's position here in Bereishis, Rashi Sheet, is very compelling. That there is such a thing called Lashon HaKodesh. There is such a thing called a language that exists independent of history, independent of human convention, independent even of Har Sinai. Not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose Hebrew as the language to create the world, because Am Yisrael would accept the Torah Har Sinai, we would think the reverse is true. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered the Torah to the Jewish people in Hebrew, and presumably they were speaking Hebrew. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted them to speak Hebrew at some point. They started speaking Hebrew because this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language. This is the language that he gave Adam, Noach, certainly Avram. So we'd like to think that it's all top-down, that Hashem chooses the language. It's Lashon HaKodesh because it's the language of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's the language that created the world, and as a consequence of that, history unfolds, Avos, Har Sinai, Torah in Hebrew. But it is an interesting point in Rashi, and it leads to a lot of interesting corollaries. For example, very important issue, that since it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language, we can't treat it as we treat other languages. What I mean is, as much as we think we know Hebrew, and of course we know, we study Hebrew, I don't just mean modern Hebrew, but it's a language that lends itself to coding, to references, to meanings that we can't know because it isn't based in human experience. It's a completely different language. I can study English or French very thoroughly and understand its context, its nuance, its meanings. I can read a novel and I can pretty much cover and articulate all the various meanings. But Hebrew, because it's a language that HaKadosh Baruch Hu installed, there are going to be levels of interpretation and ways to interpret that lie beyond human reach, beyond human ken. This is a fascinating conversation that emerged a lot in the end of the 18th century, certainly the 19th century, where Maskilim were starting to, I wouldn't say deride, but maybe that's a good word. They were certainly trivializing Chazal's drashos, because after all, we all know that most, to be fair and honest, most of Chazal's drashos are not the literal meaning of the pasuk. Gzeres Shavah is not the literal way to read. The extra vav, the extra yod, the extra lamed, the deconstructionist that takes place, taking down words and senses into small little letters and learning two or three ideas from extra letters. That's not how you and I would read the book of the Torah. It's not pshat, as we would say. So there really are two responses to this. One response is, you're right, it's not pshat, but it's drash. And drash is one of the ways that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to read the Torah. There is a masara. Even though it's not the way you would read it, it's not the simple reading, but these are the drashas that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered to Moshe Har Sinai, and these are the connecting points. And so it's not pshat, it's not, it's... And drash isn't any less important, chas v'shalom. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intention. It's the source of halacha. But there is another response, which is even more audacious. And I think it was stated in part by the Malbim. He said, no, this is pshat. You just don't know how to read pshat because you are superimposing your typical linguistic reading skills from French, from English, from German, onto Hebrew. But Hebrew is divine. I mean, he'd say it this way. I'm just connecting it to Rashi. But if Hebrew is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language, then we're totally lost in the wind. We're totally lost when we read Hebrew because we're trying to determine what pshat is, what's literal reading, based on human conventions, how we're trained to speak in English or German or French or Russian. But that training is totally, totally irrelevant regarding Hebrew because the dynamics of Hebrew are totally different. It's a totally different language. I wouldn't even call it a language. It's the Kodesh Baruch Hu's language. It's Lashon HaKodesh. And we have some way to read. It certainly in no way diminishes the importance of reading the Torah the way we'd read normal languages. And certainly today in Eretz Yisrael is a renaissance of learning Tanakh al pi pshat, not the drushas, not Chazal's superimposition of all these drushas, but simply how can you just read? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lo nitna Torah l'malachei asharis, he gave it to us and he wants us to read it as human beings, but that can't be the be-all and end-all. That can't be the comprehensive way to view. Let's denigrate ways that veer from pshat because we don't even have fixed north. We don't have a compass to determine what pshat is, what isn't. So we'd say there are different levels of pshat. Again, it seems semantics, whether it's pshat or drash, but it really isn't. Another interesting thing is the importance of learning Hebrew. Today, sadly, there are many, many people who aren't that conversant in Hebrew because it's not just another language. It's not just the language of the Jewish people. It's different from Yiddish. A lot of people today still value Yiddish because it's our language and it's the language of the last 700 years in Eastern Central Europe, and it's the language that produced so much Torah. And certainly those are valid claims. And once a language is responsible for a culture, for heritage, for Torah, for survival, for identity, so the language becomes inherent, well, I would say inherently, nothing about the letters and the words and the conjugations, but it becomes sociologically part of our identity. It's important to retain it. You can even have a level of Kedusha because, again, it's imbued from Kedusha, bottom up, from usage and utility. But Hebrew is not just another language that the ancient Israelites employed and that one and the Torah was written in. Hebrew is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language. So to speak Hebrew is to speak in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's language. On the other hand, to be fair, it would then determine that there's a certain rigidity to Hebrew as opposed to other languages. And that raises the question of how we relate to modern Hebrew. Because modern Hebrew, although it's built primarily on Tanakh and Mishnah and Gemara Hebrew, there are many, 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 many modern words that have nothing to do with Tanakh. So someone like myself, I believe, well, that's part of the evolution of language. Is now the Am Yisrael, these aren't These aren't Brazilians who are speaking this language in Brazil. These are Jewish people who've returned to build their nation. And part of rebuilding identity is recovering language, because we lost language. Language went static in many ways for thousands of years. And now we have to come up, and of course, especially in the modern era, where there's such dynamic change in our world, technology, words that we can never imagine. So we have to come up with words. Sometimes the words are borrowed from other languages, but once it becomes incorporated in the Hebrew language of the Jewish people in their state, then it has a status. I wouldn't say it has a status of Kedusha, but it certainly has a status that makes it different from English or French, and therefore worthwhile to study. But if you read this Rashi literally, it may not, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't deliver those words. Hashem didn't deliver the word telephones, even though in Hebrew we'll all use the word telephone, shlachli telephone, shlachli email, shlachli... It's not a word that HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if the language is imposed and installed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it can't evolve, it can't stream with the dynamic of change that you would expect languages to. And of course, I think it could be a little bit of both, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu installed the skeleton of the language, and then humanity, human beings, Jews, adopted the language and can alter it and can advance it. So it's just an interesting Rashi about language. I really wanted to speak about a lot more than this one Rashi, but I'll just try to fit in two other Rashis very briefly. Kayin. I'm mentioning Rashi about Kayin. So much to speak about Kayin. Kayin was terrified after his sin that anyone who would encounter him would kill him. So the question is, who exactly was Kayin fearful of? His mother? Mother, he's a murderer. He murdered her other son, Havel, but can't imagine that Chava is going to kill her one remaining son. Adam, similarly, some of the wives, some of the twins. So who exactly is Kayin fearful of? Kol Motzei Hargeini, that he requires some sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to prevent his murder. So Rashi says he's afraid of the animals, the only likely candidates to murder him. Why is he more afraid of the animals at this point? So Rashi says that Kayin was concerned that until now the animals were frightened and were afraid of him. But now that I've sinned, the animals will no longer fear me. So why is Kayin's sin responsible for the animals being less fearful of man? So there clearly are metaphysical aspects, meaning we can't trace them, and can animals sense a tzaddik, and can animals sense a rasha? But part of that, and I'd say it's metaphysical because you can't chart it scientifically, but as Kayin becomes more animal-like, the difference between humanity and animals shrinks, and of course the animals are less fearful of Kayin. So Kayin acted like an animal. Kayin killed, he was a predator. He killed his brother. So the dignity and the gap between, and again, what Kayin does and his actions affect the entire world population, because that's who he is, the world population. So it's not just an isolated sin by an isolated person, but the status and the station of humanity at large has now been altered. Mm-hmm. So Kayin now has reduced the gap between the human community and the natural world, and therefore it's more likely that the animals will attack him or will become aggressive towards him. There's a phrase, so he needs a sign, and some sign that will probably reinforce the fact that he's a human being. Human beings are different. So it's not just something magical. There's some smell that a Baal Chet has, that the smell of fear. Now the animals are no longer afraid, whereas someone who isn't a Baal Chet doesn't have that scent. But it's something more structural. Are you acting like a human being, different from the animal kingdom? Or are you acting closer to the animal kingdom? Human beings are perched very, very delicately and precipitously upon that boundary between animals and angels. And our behavior determines whether we're more angelic, in which case the animals are distant from us and different from us, or the animals are, we act more in an animal-like fashion, and we're closer to the animal kingdom. Now, I'm thinking about this because obviously it's very provocative to think about why animals should or shouldn't attack human beings. But I'm overlaying this with the corona situation, where the entire corona situation happened when a virus made the jump from the animal kingdom to the human community. Now, why does that happen? When does it happen? Obviously, there's science behind it that we don't yet know. But one thing we know is that there are, I guess, millions. I'm not a scientist, I'm not an epidemiologist, but there are scores of viruses in the animal kingdom, and they don't always make the leap. If they all made the leap, then humanity would be annihilated. So there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of viruses that are unique to the animal kingdom, which, if they infected the human community, would wreck humanity. And the question of, well, when does a virus make that leap from the animal community to the human community? There is science behind it, science that I don't know, obviously. But there's also a moral story, that the more that human beings act like animals, the smaller the gap between human beings and animals and the animal kingdom, and the more likely it is for viruses to make the leap, because you've shrunk the gap metaphysically between humans and animals. So that's certainly something that participates, just like shrinking the gap between humans and animals allows animals to be more comfortable in human quarters and to attack them and to predate them, to be predators. Similarly, shrinking the gap between human beings and animals would make it metaphysically, spiritually, more likely for viruses to make the leap from the animal kingdom to the human community, which gives us a lot to think about as we're processing corona. Certainly not to say that humanity is responsible for corona because of this sin or that sin, and that we're all God playing people, that I'm going to castigate humanity because of this or that, but we certainly feel that in the last century, it's been a bit of a moral decline in certain areas, sexuality, level of discourse, polarization, wars. So it's part of this whole process, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminding us that we have to, as we would say, up our game and act more like human beings and create more of a gap between the human community and the animal kingdom and make it less likely for viruses to take that leap from animals to humans. It's just an interesting Rashi to think about in the light of the coronavirus. Another very interesting Rashi is when the creation of man is described in the second parak. So Rashi says that man was crafted from part of the lower sphere, the terrestrial sphere, the earth, the water, the clouds, and partially from the upper sphere, the neshama, v'yipach b'yapav nishmas chayim. So we would think that this is simply to create a hybrid of both, and of course it's true. But it's interesting how Rashi phrases it, because Hashem wanted to avoid contention and strife, because the first day, the heavens were created. Second day, the heavens were created, the separation between the upper waters and the lower waters. The third day was about the lower sphere, the oceans, which primarily affects the lower sphere. The fourth day was once back in heavens, and now it's 3-1. Day one, day two, day four are heaven celestial moments. The fifth day is, of course, grounded in the lower sphere, the birds and the fish. And the sixth day, actually, I think I misspoke. The first day is equal because it's Shemayim Varet. So the first day is both heaven and earth. Second day is heaven, Rekia. Third day is heaven because of third day is the lower waters, that's the earth. Fourth day is heaven, fifth day is earth. So basically it's an even ledger, heaven and earth. So on the sixth day, to maintain that equality, shouldn't be jealousy. Yeshkina b'maisa b'reishis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to once again fashion man, just like on the first day, Shemayim Varetz. On the sixth day, there has to be a little bit from Shemayim, a little bit from Aretz, and man has to be a hybrid of the two. Now, what does it mean for the Shemayim to be jealous? What does it mean for the Aretz to be jealous? Who exactly is jealous? Which part of Shemayim? Shemayim doesn't have spirit. Even if it had spirit, which it doesn't, it certainly wouldn't be jealous. Jealousy is a human emotion. So, of course, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu demonstrating the dangers of jealousy and demonstrating to us how we should be balanced and we should be equal in our treatment of people and to avoid jealousy. I think about this a lot as a Rebbe, not to create favoritism amongst Talmidim. I remember one Talmud a long time ago once came over to me and said, Rebbe, you know, you never made me feel special from the other boys. When I was in a different yeshiva or different high school, I felt like I was the Rebbe's favorite Talmud, and that really inspired me and motivated me to grow. And I didn't tell this Talmud at the time, I just listened to his feedback, but I was horrified by what he was saying. How could I turn you into a favorite Talmud and crush the hearts and the feelings of another Talmud who will clearly sense that he's less loved, and the ABCs of parenting, the ABCs of being a Rebbe, and the ABCs of
of any collective setting is to convey a sense of equality and everyone is loved. Equality doesn't mean homogeneity, everyone's different, but certainly equality. So Kodesh Baruch was teaching us a lesson that sadly Yaakov didn't always apply, is not to show favoritism amongst your children, or amongst your students, or amongst any people that look up to you, because it can create a sense of frustration and jealousy. So Kodesh Baruch was teaching us, even though there's not really going to be jealousy in Shemayim Varez, Hashem is teaching us a moral lesson by not stoking jealousy, not prompting jealousy. But what's fascinating about it is that we would think that the issues of heaven are more important than the issues of earth. The earth is just this transient way station that human beings spend a little bit of time on. So why should the needs, in theory, if you play out this metaphor, why should the needs of earth even be taken into account? It's just earth. It's not Shemayim. Shemayim is HaKadosh Baruch Hu is about. Shemayim is eternal. Shemayim is the upper spheres. Why should the lower spheres? And it just reminds us that both are important and that life is meant to be a fusion of the two. And ultimately, and not so ironically, man is the great equalizer. Man is the one being that can fuse Shemayim and Aretz and can create that sense of equality. Obviously, not just in terms of Shemayim's feelings and Aretz's feelings, but in terms of human perspective. And we should value Shemayim and value Aretz and invest in Aretz and fuse the two and see our lives as building our future Olam Haba in this world and then continuing a life of spirituality unencumbered in the next world. So it's a very, very deep Rashi, A, about moral instruction from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to avoid creating jealousy, but also about man at his birth. This is the creation of man, all humanity. Man was fused between the two and created equality between the two, and it's a message of how we view human life. We're meant to both partake of the heavens and the earth. Shabbat Shalom.